This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Alex von Goldstein and Rabbit. Great having you guys on the show again.
Great to be back.
Aloha, guys.
So we're going to be discussing future predictions and a lot of trends and kind of how our society has been in decay and how people see the future possible scenarios. I think a good place to kind of get started off with is the concept of self-sufficiency. And there's this kind of a conservative idea of self-sufficiency, which basically is like owning your own home in the suburbs and working for a corporation as long as you're not on the government dole. That's basically like your mainline conservative view. And then there's the kind of LARPy traditionalist types who think everyone should grow their own food. I'm not opposed to like the second part. I'm a big supporter of things like small farms and people growing their own food, but I just don't think it's realistic for everyone to kind of live that lifestyle.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I respect some of those people, but you know, I'm not one of those who wants to live like the Amish or anything. Like, I don't really revere that kind of a lifestyle. You know, I'm not really interested in going back or anything like that. I'm interested in you know, continuing forward, at least in terms of knowledge and whatnot. Not you know, grandma making what's that one guy's quote? It's like socialism is the empty butter shells of capitalism. I can't believe it's not butter. And traditionalism, grandma makes the butter. You know, well, it's like a really popular quote that one guy tweeted. Well, I think Wagner Clemente Soto, but that doesn't appeal to me at all. The idea of grandma making the butter or whatnot. I'm not into any of that that down home stuff, to be honest.
Well, you see with the agriculture, like I think corporate agriculture has devastated like the small farms. Don't get me wrong, I'm a big supporter of like small farming and small towns. I just think some of these radical traditionalist types take things like way too far.
Yeah, they want to recreate the past. And there's part of like living in a small is beautiful type setting that really does appeal to me. You know, I guess I'm maybe a dialectical opposite of Rabbit there in that I kind of like the idea of grandma making the butter and like having duties to the people that live in your town. And I mean, I feel like that's the way that our, American society was developing until we sort of hit this kind of like acceleration. So, I mean, I think that that's a place where you could have kind of like more of a mental balance. The problem is now I think we've gone too far. You know, I would like grandma to make the butter, but I just can't really imagine a society like that developing. I can't really imagine a return to the past, even though part of me likes that kind of the sense of, slow pace and high trust that seems to have come with the times.
Yeah, see, I wish that we could just eat, like, food tablets, you know. Like, I'd like to just do away with the whole idea of, cooking shit all together. You know, just, like, push a button and the machine.
Do you like cooking?
You know. Do I? No.
Oh, okay. I like cooking.
I don't like cooking. I don't even care, much about food. I know a lot of people are just, like, especially in America, just obsessed with food and just like flavor and things like
well, yeah, I mean, that's
just, like,
the one thing you're allowed to do in life is to take pictures of the food you cooked or food you're going to eat. That's sort of like
well,
a meaning of life for a lot of people.
Yeah,
but
a lot of people,
yeah,
their lives are so miserable. Like going out to a nice restaurant and having a good meal is like one of their one of the joys in life.
Is that a miserable thing though? Or I mean, if that's the thing. It's like if they can enjoy it, that's the problem. It's like we see that as like, oh my God, these people are so pathetic that they're crying over these cupcakes, but they're really enjoying it. But yeah, it is kind of pathetic though.
But you do have this interesting phenomenon. We've touched on this a lot on our previous shows among like us Whipples and wealthy people. They kind of want the best of both worlds of things like urbanism and the kind of a traditional rural lifestyle. And you see that with like farmers markets and also a lot of, I mean, I can't really speak so much for other parts of the country, but if you look at a lot of the wealthiest suburbs in California, they try to kind of spark a balance between urbanism and having access to nature. And Southern California has a few places that are a little bit like that. I mean, Southern California has been pretty much wrecked by suburban sprawl. But I think in California, the best example would be like a lot of the Bay Area suburbs, like places like Marin County would be the best example, but even places like Palo Alto and a lot of the wealthy East Bay suburbs, they're places where you're in close proximity to a big city like San Francisco, but you're also surrounded by wilderness. And I think that is sort of the ideal way to live if you can afford it. But that's kind of an extreme luxury item. And on our previous show, I know we mentioned we were talking about places like Boulder and how those places are luxury items. Alex, do you have places like that on the East Coast that are comparable? I'm sure you do.
In what sense? Like that they sort of meet like urban sprawl and farmers market swivel? with the cross section between those two?
Well, small places that have the best balance of kind of a small town's access to wilderness, but also access to urbanism. I mean, originally, if you look
at...
That's
what a lot of North Jersey is like, you know, these sort of rustic-type small towns. I mean, it's funny. You go between, like, total Sopranos country, where there's a, you know, bodega on every corner, and, you know, everyone is, like, a Polish immigrant... to, you know, 12 towns over, 5 towns over, like, Swipple country where, like, Stephen Colbert lives.
I didn't know the Poles were still immigrating here. Like, my great-grandparents came here from Poland, like, 100 years ago.
Oh, I mean, there's a town, if I walk, like, you know, half an hour the other way, I'm, like, in Poland. The signs are in, like, Polish and stuff.
Here in California, like, most white people are like a hybrid of like 10 different like ethnicities. It's almost quite rare to meet someone who's like a fully German or fully Irish.
We got the Irish Italian blend people. That's like a New Jerseyan, an Irish Italian person, and then we have as far as the other kinds of white people around here, there's the Poles. And that's basically it. And then you have you have scatterings of other Eastern Europeans. And I'm sort of one of those people, I guess.
Yeah, I lived in Los Angeles, and there was definitely a lot of Russians there. There were tons of Russian, you know, storefronts and things that were just like completely in Russian. Like you just wouldn't even go in there because nothing was in. It was all in Russian. Which, you know, I can understand Spanish a little bit, but, you know, to go into a Russian store, like, I would have absolutely no idea, like, what anything is. So,
kind of back to our topic, I was listening to a TED Talk by James Howard Kunstler, and what he was saying is what happened is you had the sort of a rail suburbs around the turn of the century, and they started out as these small towns on railroads, and people commuted from those. And those were the towns, they're very common on the East Coast, but we have a few places in California that fit that model, like Pasadena, California is a good example. And those are the kind of places that have become very desirable to live. Then in the 50s, we had the beginning of like the car-oriented suburban sprawl. Like the first like major tract housing development was like Levittown on Long Island. So we had this sort of long trend in from basically the 50s to the late 20th century of urban sprawl. And I know Kunstler, he has this whole theory of like a peak oil and how we're going to have this massive economic collapse caused by peak oil and how the suburbs are all going to kind of decay. So that kind of gets us to the overall theme of the show, is where we're sort of headed as a society. There's sort of people have different solutions, and then there's also the kind of like nightmare scenarios. So both versions, the futurist version, there's sort of a futurist nightmare scenario, which would be like best described by like 1984. And A Brave New World is a kind of a maybe softer, more sort of humane version of that, where people are kind of conditioned to enjoy their slavery. And then there's a sort of a Mad Max scenario, which is a kind of a chaos scenario. And then you have people like Kunstler predicts that suburbs will break down and with peak oil, and that people will kind of be forced to live in these like small towns and return to local agriculture. I also interviewed John Robb. He's from Global Guerrillas, and he writes a lot about fourth generation warfare. He also is a strong believer in peak oil, and he predicts that people will sort of have to be forced to return to this kind of extreme kind of localism. And with we kind of talked about like decentralization with Keith Preston and the idea of a city state, but I don't think decentralization has to be like this extreme Luddite model where everyone's growing their own food and having to have this like barter economy. I mean, you could have like a really futuristic city state.
Well, obviously, the thing is, it's like decentralization. I think a lot of people, they just have this almost religious belief in the power of the federal government and needing this huge overarching bureaucracy to make sure everything stays in check. But the thing is, I think a lot of people have their own ideas of how things should be governed and could do that, you know, could actually just do that themselves. You know, so all these communist types, they could just make an ANCOM society somewhere else. I mean, I know it sounds a little ridiculous, but I think that we have a lot of ideological tension, and if we do hit something like peak oil or a huge financial collapse, it would be better to try and see if we could separate ourselves on that level, or, you know, I don't know, or we would just probably have total war. I'm not really sure.
And then what could happen, the best case scenario, is you'd have all these independent city states. One would be communist, maybe. One would be libertarian. One would be like traditionalist, kind of Luddites. One could be more like futurist, like almost like kind of like a Hong Kong type place. And all they'd experiment with different ideas. And then the best ideas would sort of win out. These mega countries like the United States as it is now, like if you get a bad idea, you're kind of stuck with it. With these themes, I'd like to sort of get into each kind of scenario in more detail and sort of analyze it and what could lead to that scenario and what are possible outcomes. So I think to start off with is a kind of, let's start off with a sort of Mad Max scenario. Where there's just complete chaos and everything breaks down and there's rioting. Want to comment on that? Like what could lead to that, and then what are the outcomes?
I don't know. I see the way of getting there is probably due to some kind of a major currency or stock collapse or some kind of a natural disaster. Something serious where you have a breakdown in infrastructure, power goes out for like 20 days, something where it's like no, I could see it through that way. I don't really see a Mad Max type scenario. I see more tribal conflict, and then before it would get to a Mad Max type scenario, I see something coming in to kind of fill the void of authority. Yeah.
Well, there's kind of frog in the boiling pan theory, and I know a lot of the like Alex Jones types think they say that the elites want to have chaos so they can consolidate their power. But I don't necessarily agree with that. I think what the powers that be want is they want a sort of gradual decay, and they want people to get used to a lower quality of life so they don't rebel. I mean, just look at the whole migrant crisis in Europe. That's led to a massive backlash. You had the Brexit and the whole election in Austria, where it looks like there might be a recount. But there's been this massive backlash, so I'm more of a believer in the frog in the boiling pan theory than Alex Jones's theory that the elites want, like, constant chaos.
Yeah, well, I don't think that, like, I don't believe in these conspiracies. Like, I don't think that the elites, they just sit around, like, this is what they want for us. I think that they're looking out for their own specific interests, and they just don't care about this. I don't think that they're actively like, rubbing their hands like, we want to create chaos. What they're doing is they're saying like, this is the situation that makes me the most money. It benefits me. And they're not thinking in terms of the collective or even long term. Like, they may be thinking long term in terms of like the GDP will go up if we keep doing this, but they're not thinking in those kind of micro, I don't think those kind of terms.
Steve Saylor said that these elite types, like an Angela Merkel, their time preference is 3 days. They're just thinking in terms of like the next 3 days. Because these people are basically members of like a corporate bureaucracy. They have, did you guys get a chance to look through Hillary Clinton's emails? It's just, constant. She just has all these like news articles being sent to her about things she's done and doing PR constantly. Like, how can we look good? How can we keep this thing afloat? And how can we look good? And I feel like that's what's on their minds.
Exactly. That's the thing, is like a lot of people out there make these elites out to be this all powerful, omnipotent force. And that makes people feel that intimidates them, like not that they can.
They don't want to speak out.
Yeah, they're not these like super geniuses
that people think Hillary Clinton is like Darth Vader, and then she goes into the room and George Soros' face pops up on the hologram. That's what these people think happened. And, maybe Soros sends her an email every now and then. I saw Kissinger was talking to her in those emails. But, I don't think that they have grand. I think the problem with these people is they don't have grand ideological visions. They don't have a sense of like the future. They're not civilization. They just want
to have grand visions for the future. The problem with the society is that everyone, the masses and the elites, are both thinking like, what can they do to get like instant gratification?
Exactly, it's a time preference problem. So like maybe that's acceleration. I don't know if I believe in that kind of accelerationist shit, but that could be it.
They're not thinking in terms of, 50 years from now, like what will these effects be on our society? They're thinking of, like, I can't believe you don't pander to these people. Like, how do you expect to win this election? How do you expect to win the election in 4 years if you only have 20% of the Hispanic vote or something? They're not thinking in terms of like, what would be the impact? What these demographic changes? What would be the implications on our society and infrastructure and resources in 40 years from now to bring in millions of people? Like, they're just thinking in terms of like, how do we navigate this to our benefit right now?
Well, they don't want bad press. That's like the biggest thing for these people, is if they're getting good press or not. And I feel like Donald Trump, he's sort of this, you know, media wizard type where he realizes, you know, any publicity is good publicity. So he's like, I can sacrifice getting bad press and cutting off a certain part of the population from ever voting for me. But, you know, that bad press could be good press for these other people. So the thing about Donald Trump is I feel like, you know, me and Robert, we were talking to Keith about this. It's like, I think a lot of people who kind of think like we do or like we do, whatever, they view Donald Trump like he's more than he actually is. Like, I think Donald Trump is closer to being a kind of bureaucratic figure. Like, maybe he does have grander ideas than these people, but I still think he is a bit of a bureaucratic managerial type leader. He just has a lot of finesse.
If you look at Putin in Russia, he started out as being part of the establishment under the Yeltsin regime, and then once he got into power, he changed things a lot, and he cleaned up a lot of the corruption and pushed the country more in a nationalist direction.
Yeah, well, the thing is Obama, I mean, if you think about the kind of cultural changes that have occurred in the last, you know, 4 years even, I think a lot of that is due to the Obama administration. Maybe I'm drinking too much Alex Jones Kool-Aid there. But I do think that the Obama administration has had a pretty profound impact on the lives of day-to-day Americans. Do you guys agree with that?
I mean, I think that he's definitely created a lot more white racists than there were before. I think compared to like 2008, definitely a lot more division. And in terms of like day-to-day life, I don't really see that much difference. Except one big difference is that the healthcare has been made a difference, but I don't really know whether it's really improved anything or made it worse. It's definitely been a substantial difference to what was the place before.
I mean, healthcare was something. I mean, it wasn't handled the right way, but I did take advantage of that. And being someone who's like, I'm kind of like a big anti-state thinker, so you know, taking government aid to get something done, I don't know. I felt like I had to like give in some of my autism points there.
Rabbit, do you want to comment on the whole sort of like Kunstler's scenario where peak oil leads to this sort of utopia where we return back to the way things were 100 years ago, where people are living in small towns and growing their own food?
I don't really see it because we're already getting to a stage where they're figuring out how to do things without oil. I think if we ran out, I don't think it would be like a Mad Max scenario or anything like that. It might be a little bit hectic for a while, but I think that they have there's enough ways around that to where I don't think it would be a huge issue. I do think that the oil is something that I always point to when people talk about population and birth rates and things like that, immigration, because as far as I'm concerned, we're overpopulated if we have to import, millions of barrels of oil, in a country as big as ours, we have pretty, heavy oil resources in, Texas, Alaska, South Dakota. Now, theoretically, we shouldn't be having to import any, so if we're having to import millions, then that means that we're then we have too many people. We should have, our resources should be able to sustain our population. It's one thing to trade and things like that. If it's something you don't have any of, then you can trade with other countries for it.
I don't really see there being this massive collapse due to peak oil. I think we'll sort of adjust to things. I think there'll be more investment in alternative energy. I think there's things new urbanism, where some suburbs, the cheaper suburbs, I think will just decay and turned into ghettos. And you're already seeing that right now in a lot of the cheaper suburbs. You see vacant malls and foreclosed homes. But I do see a lot of suburbs being more kind of revitalized and urbanized. So you'll see like this trend already with new urbanism, where you see strip malls being turned into kind of a medium density of walkable communities. So
with
I
fast,
think over
casual
time,
we'll, restaurants.
Yeah, we'll
replacing
just,
fast food. I mean, I noticed that with the Wendy's by my house. It sort of revamped itself. It doesn't look so much like a shitty fast food place now. It is like almost a Starbucks or something. Like, it has this, I don't know, I feel like these places have all revamped their menus and are now, they're giving you these, like, fast food hamburgers, but they sort of look like restaurant hamburgers. And it's pretty funny, because I read some Jeffrey Tucker thing on this, and he loved it. He's talking about how the free market can produce this stuff. It's absolutely ridiculous. But yeah, I mean, I feel like that's a strange thing that's happening now, is that these super, just to sound like a total hippie here, it's like these super corporate, disgusting places are able to produce food at nicer, like, levels, it's a bit more edible now. So I feel like that's, you know, it kind of comes in that Brave New World side of things, where it's not disgusting. You can go and have something that's tastes pretty good, but at the same time, you really don't know what you're eating, and you're supporting this huge, disgusting monster.
Yeah, I think that part of that is interesting because, I grew up in the 80s, so I can really remember when, when I was a kid, this fast food was just complete garbage. You know, it came in styrofoam. It looked like it was just like straight out of a factory, you know, just disgusting, like the tiniest piece of meat and, really probably the cheapest possible bread you can use. And it seems like a lot of the, the more health-oriented kind of, leftist movements of the 90s that drove people to seek out these healthier options kind of forced the fast food places and whatnot they had such a horrible reputation that they had to kind of step it up in order to keep up with these people that are just have decided that, you know, McDonald's and this stuff is just total garbage. You know, that's
they're just going
that's
to Five Guys.
What their brand is.
They're going to Five Guys and Panera.
Yeah.
One other trend is that there's always been this kind of belief that the American dream is that you have to own like a single family home. But now you have like all these millennials coming about, and I mean, they can't afford any home whatsoever. They can barely afford like a studio apartment with roommates. So you have different ways of thinking on urban planning. You have like NIMBYism both on the conservative and the liberal side, but a lot of people who already own a home are opposed to any kind of densification. But I do think when millennials get more political power, I think their outlook on urban planning is going to change because most of them didn't have the opportunity to own a single family home. And we're seeing like what's happened is we've had all this massive immigration, which has increased the population. But that's led to this massive demand for housing. So I think it is inevitable that we are going to see denser cities. Suburbs are going to be like urbanized, and cities are going to start building more skyscrapers. My opinion on this is kind of it's a little bit outside both the liberal and conservative view. On one hand, I'd like to see a dramatic reduction in immigration, but at the same time, I think if we do need to increase the housing supply, I think urbanism is much more preferable to like building more single-family homes.
Well, it's strange. I mean, so since the mid-60s, we've had a huge increase in immigration, and I think that it's strange because, you know, there's so much immigration. I think we bring in 1.3 million people every year. and our population is rising. It's getting higher and higher. And I feel like these, you know, these the people that run our government would understand that this is a dangerous thing that they're doing, and they don't stop doing it. So that I don't understand it, and it makes that's what makes me a bit conspiratorial sometimes, because I really can't understand like why someone who's running a system that can't even support the people that are currently in it would continue bringing more people into that system.
I mean, I think that it's just because if they own a company, it benefits them personally, you know, because they can they can get cheaper labor, you know, mm-hmm. which is why they keep bringing in you know these Indians and whatnot that they can, you know, they can pay
for the H-1B visas.
Yeah, they can pay them, you know, 10 or 20 grand less per year than what they would pay someone else. And so they can't understand, like, this is good for business. Like, why wouldn't you support it? But the, you know, in order for, you know, Americans would have to be willing to allow their standard of living to drop, you know, because I think, like, the average worldwide salary or something is, like, $5,000 or $10,000 per year, you know. So anyone who makes that amount anywhere else would... You know, you're having to compete with them if they come here because they're like, ooh, you know, 15 grand a year. Like, I'm, you know, sign me up. And so you're having to compete. They always say that these corporations and the CEOs and the politicians always say, like, oh, well, you're just worried about immigration because you can't compete with these people. But in reality, can't compete means in the business sense, which is you can't. We're not willing to work for and lower our standard of living enough to match these people, as if it's just like a sale at Walmart or something.
Yeah,
it's not the same.
Then you have these sort of utopian futurist visions. There's like a utopian model where people have like a basic income, and like the robots and machines are doing all the work, and people can devote all their time and energy to intellectual and creative pursuits. We have like a high-speed rail and monorails that, and people are living in these like magnificent utopian cities. But the thing about that kind of that type of futurist model, and it's kind of the vision that the futurist films depicted in a lot of the 50s and 60s films, even some of the 70s films, that would be a great way to live, but I think it's possible in like only European or Northeast Asian societies. I don't think it's compatible with like a third world society.
Well, the problem with all of this stuff is that it assumes that people can adapt to, you know, these higher levels of technology and accelerated ways of living their lives. And I think it's funny that you mentioned North Asian countries, because if you look at Japan, you know, which is a you know, really, really homogeneous nation, they have a lot of and they have, you know, super accelerated technology, you know, this, like, you know, it's really capitalistic driven society. They still have, you know, a strong sense of identity and honor and tradition and all this stuff, but the problem is they still have declining birth rates. People are not able to keep up with what's going on there. You have all these hikikomoros in their parents' apartment, you know, living in a room covered in anime toys. You know, women aren't having sex, men are masturbating to anime porn, you know. It's like, you know, like, that doesn't seem good.
Yeah, I think that declining birth rates are a good thing if you have a country like Japan, which is already overpopulated. I think, I mean, Japan's the same size as California, but it has three times the population. And I think California has too many people. So I think that Japan's declining birth rates, what happens is, you know, these people in Japan live in, like, a lot of them live in, like, cubby holes, you know. So when the birth rates decline to a point where there's open spaces, then suddenly the people have more room to operate. And, you know, if you live in like a Japanese apartment or something, like, there's no way that you would want to have three or four kids. I mean, it's just like, you just wouldn't want to do it. And but Japan is smart, though, because If you have declining birth rates and you have a democratic society, what you don't want is to bring in immigrants that are, that have high birth rates and that are from the third world, that are they're going to displace you. So Japan can afford declining birth rates, for 50 or 100 years, as long as they're not bringing other people in, because they're not being invaded. That's the problem the U.S. has, is that, white people have declining birth rates, but they're bringing in hordes of these other people that have kids like crazy.
Rabbit, what do you think about, Frank Lloyd Wright's idea of having everyone living in, mile-high skyscrapers and then having everything else, as being, parks and wilderness?
I think it's good, but I think I support having futurist cities, but with without crowded populations. So smaller populations, but in big cities where essentially it's like a like a Logan's Run type scenario where you have these people living in these futurist cities or whatever, but it's not, the population is strictly controlled and you don't have, because I think that what makes some of these cities miserable to live in is just that, the massive amount of people. I think that leads to, a devaluing of human life, because there's just hordes of people. So, someone dies, it's just like a bug or something,
I want to touch upon the basic income, which I brought up, and I did a show with Anthony Mickles about this, and we also were on our show with Zoltan Itzvan of the Transhumanist Party, this concept, and there's two different scenarios with a basic income, and one you could have a utopian society, as I kind of talked about, where the robots do all the work, and all the money goes to the people, and people are free to pursue all these intellectual pursuits and creative pursuits. But there could also be a kind of nightmare scenario, and that's what I talked about with Anthony Mickles. He supports the idea if it's done right, but one sort of nightmare scenario would be that basically the elite basically loots the middle class. They start off by not just through taxation, but through all kinds of things like usury, and they basically automize all the jobs, so all the jobs are gone. So then you have these middle-class people, and they're maybe making like $80,000 a year, but they do give them a basic income, but the basic income is maybe like $15,000 a year or $20,000 a year. So they get the basic income, but it's still a big decline in standard of living. I think a basic income could be a great thing if done right, but it could also be used in a more nefarious way.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely support the idea of a basic income, and I think with the rise of automation in the coming century, it's inevitable. But I think that we need to have a strong culture, or for people to develop their own cultures, strong cultures, strong senses of identity alongside this, because if people continue to be atomized as they are now, and are given that kind of total freedom, I think it would just result in endless depression and crimes. People have nothing to do with their lives. People have such a false sense of what the world is right now.
That's happened in a lot of the Arab Gulf states. They have all this oil wealth, and they do get a basic income. But you have a lot of young men, and they get bored, and then a lot of them end up becoming jihadis because they have no purpose in life. And
they need a higher thing to live for. They need something to die for, and that's the problem with freedom, is that when people are given too much of it, if they have freedom without identity, they look for identity and they want the strongest, most insane, violent animal spirit of that identity, because they totally lack it.
So Rabbit made this comment about these futurist cities and about how these are really high population places are miserable places to live. And that kind of brings us to the discussion of this is a controversial topic, but I'll talk about it anyway, a sort of a eugenics versus dysgenics. And there's this sort of, there's that angle to it, and then there's also the wealth angle to it. And liberals will complain that the rich, I mean, not like phony neoliberals, but the leftists will complain that there's too much wealth concentrated in the hands of a few. And I agree with that. I have different solutions and ideas, but I basically agree with that basic premise. And then conservatives will go on this rant about how you have this big, lazy underclass who's on welfare. But when it comes down to it, nobody's saying this. The problem is that the ultra-rich control too much of the wealth, and the underclass controls too much of the population. And that basically is not something that's addressed by either the left or the right.
Well, you're basically heading to the RK selection theory there. And, yeah, I think the problem with that is we have all these Enlightenment ideas about the universal humanity and then Christian ideas about universal humanity. So, you know, to be honest, I can't see something like HBD going mainstream anytime soon. But Mike Judge made an impact on, you know, on this discussion by making the film Idiocracy, because that movie basically said people with high IQs are not having children, and people with low IQs are having many children. And that idea is with, you know, it's out there in the collective consciousness. People know that from Idiocracy, because it's in a movie.
This is basically a thought experiment. I mean, I'm not putting this out as a concrete proposal. It is very kind of coercive and some might say status. It's just a thought experiment. But maybe it'd be interesting if we had a policy. So for, say, the underclass, we give them a basic income or a negative income tax. So say each person gets like $20,000 a year for doing nothing. But the more kids they have, the more reduction they get in that basic income. So say if they don't have kids, they get $20,000. If they have one kid, they get $10,000, two kids, $5,000. And if they have like three or four kids, they don't get anything. Then for the rich, you could dramatically increase taxes on the ultra rich. But then for people who are, say, fairly well off, offer dramatic tax breaks for having more kids. So that would punish the rich for having too much money, but reward high IQ people for having more kids. That would redistribute wealth to the poor, but under the condition that they don't overpopulate society. So that's something that I'm not going to officially endorse that policy like a politician, but I'm putting it out there as a thought experiment. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that, I mean, I've heard ideas floated like that before. And I think that for the lower IQ people, their drive to reproduce sexually is so strong that there's almost no way to disincentivize them from making babies. Like, it would have to be, there would have to be some kind of force attached to it. Like, you know, you get this money in exchange for sterilization or in exchange for birth control shots, you know, things like that. I don't think that just...
Well, Rabbit, can't there be an ideal... Yeah. Can't there be an ideological reason for these people? I'm sure that when people were more religious, they were having... low IQ people, when they were more religious, were having less children. I mean, we could probably look into that. I'm not sure, though. But I would imagine that there could be, you know, ideas set in place that could make people change their behavior.
Rabbit, I know you're fairly hardcore antinatalist. Do you think there are some people who should be having more kids?
I wouldn't even say that I'm really an antinatalist. I just think that people who just kind of take this, like, this surface level, superficial view of things like, oh, birth rates are below replacement rates, you know, for Europeans or whites or whatever, like, they're going to be out, you know, outbred by these other people. They need to have more kids to replace themselves. Whereas I think that a lot of these groups are already overpopulated, and I don't think that people with future time orientation or high IQ or whatever, that they're going to be, you're not going to convince them to try to out-hump these people who don't think about any consequences whatsoever, you know, because they're just, their minds aren't wired that way. So I think that the key is to get to separate from these people. I think that I don't think in terms of like America or, you know, or these countries. Like, I'm in a post-American mindset in terms of like, we go somewhere else, we do something else, we keep everyone else out, and there's, you know, we're not going to stick to these hundreds of millions of people that are here and, you know, mobilize them to do anything great or to fix anything. Like, it's too late. You need to take like 30,000 or 40,000 people and just get the hell out, do something else, and just leave these other people to their own devices.
Yeah. That's why I support decentralization, because I think that there are many people that are in the position you're in ideologically, where they've had enough of this whole thing, and they feel that if, you know, this is just going to collapse, it's not going to go anywhere, so you might as well do what you want to do. And I feel like if more people adopted that mindset, and I mean people that are coming from all different kinds of ideologies, adopted that mindset of, let's just get the hell out of this and start something new, and didn't buy into the bigger picture of the current federal government, I think actual change could happen.
Rabbit, I was talking to you about Sheriff Joe Arpaio, and you live in Maricopa County in Phoenix, and this ties in with a lot of these issues with issues that we've been covering, like issues like immigration and the police state. And you were telling me you have kind of mixed feelings about him, because on one hand you support that he's enforcing immigration laws, but you also don't like a lot of the police state stuff, and you don't like how he treats people in his jail.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I think that a lot of conservatives have this idea that, you know, jail, it shouldn't be a nice place. It's punishment. When you go there, it should be, you know, it should be as hellish as possible to make you, you know, not want to go there or something like that. And I think that, you know, for someone who commits, a minor crime or, you know, that isn't going to be in prison for life or something, I think that if you're putting them into any kind of prison or jail type situation, and you know that they're coming back out into society, you don't want them to come back out. You don't want them to go in there and become even more monstrous if they come out. So a lot of conservatives think like, oh, it should be all about punishment and not rehabilitation. Well, maybe so if the person is sentenced, you know, for 250 years, but if he's only in there for
most people who end up in prison, like 90% of them or more, are going to get out at some point.
Yeah, and if they're going to get, if you know that they're going to get out, then you want them to be coming out more docile than they were in the game, and not these like these hardened monsters.
It's almost like it's a criminal creating machine. Like, you go in as a low-tier felon, you join a gang, you beat up a ton of guys, and you come out like a criminal 2.0.
Conservatives they say like really stupid stuff like, oh, it's a deterrent, but it's really not, because for criminals, it's a rite of passage. It's basically the equivalent of going to university. They actually, a lot of times, they see it as a rite of passage, and they learn skills and become a better
criminal. Oh, they want to go meet the top dog. Like, the top dog is in jail. Like, you go and join the Crips, and you go shoot a couple Bloods, and it's like, hey, if you really want to know how to beat these guys, you got to go to jail and meet T-Dog. and then you go to jail and, like, make up the rounds to T-Dog, and, like, he teaches you how to hustle better than any other guy. So, like, that's the thing. It's like, if you're living, you know, because, like, reading Alain Benoit, it made me realize that different cultures have different ways of seeing and, like, different ways of viewing the world, you know, and like, you can see this in, like, religions, too. It's like, if you completely believe in a religion, you have a totally different way of viewing the world, like, what's important, what's your absolute truth. So, if you're a person growing up in, you know, a ghetto-type situation, and you're in the Crips, you're going to view reality in a way that is completely different from some, you know, Korean kid living in a suburb.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, I separate, you know, violent criminals from other types of criminals. So a lot of people have this this opinion that, like, oh, you know, this person that cheated on his taxes or whatever, like, you know, he should be in, you know, prison with these other murderers or whatever. Like, I'm sorry, but that's not the same thing as, like, someone who, you know, randomly rapes and murders someone. It's not the same type of threat to society. You know, so I don't like this idea. And same thing for someone, you know, someone who goes to jail for, like, you know, having a couple of joints of marijuana, you know, possession of marijuana or something like that. Like, that is not the same thing as somebody who, you know, robs somebody at gunpoint or something like that. I think if you put all of these people into just these shitty, like, hellish prisons, you know, these people that go in there for these nonviolent crimes come out as more violent, criminalized people. And I don't think that the punishment is suitable for someone who's nonviolent to just be put in this, like, this totally violent situation.
Yeah, but there's also a kind of glamorization of the sort of lumpen proletariat life. I don't think it's there as much, but in the late 90s, you saw that a lot with Eminem and Limp Bizkit. These bands being popular and kids kind of, you know, like, there was sort of a decline in the social conservatism of the youth of America, and I think the late 90s was when it totally just flipped on itself and went beyond repair, and
we talked about that, yeah, kind of earlier on this show with Rabbit, how in the 90s you had, like, the hipsters and you had, like, the wiggers and the douchebags, but now just all those, like, genres are just kind of merging together into one big,
yeah, there's a way you're supposed to act. You're supposed to, like, eat cool food and watch cool movies and listen to cool music and keep your mouth shut about everything.
Yeah, I think that the idea of all of those styles and genres merging together is something you can completely see, where we talked about this before, is you have, like, you know, these, like, hipsters are now, like, instead of, like, you know, watching, like, 1960s Italian films or something, like, they're listening to, like Beyonce and things like that. And then you have these the kind of the merging of all of this stuff, where you'd have someone who sounds like super ghetto, but he, you know, he looks like he's wearing clothing from, like, the future in Back to the Future 2, you know, just like a pink t-shirt and like a real fruity, like, kind of
where you
hat.
See, if you go, a good example of that is you see people, if you go to Whole Foods, you see that all the time, like, people who are buying, like, all this expensive food. And they're kind of semi hipster, but also a little bit ghetto.
Yeah, but that's swag, though.
Yeah.
I guess there is something about being lax in your apparel. It's not too bad if you're just going to go to the grocery store. But I wanted to bring up this Frank Zappa quote.
Oh.
Where, I mean, just talking about how these hipsters, you know, they'd be like, watching Fellini and Antonioni movies, and then now they're just mindless retards listening to Beyonce. I think Zappa said that when you have a culture that's fixated around nostalgia, the time that you're nostalgic for is eventually going to you're going to catch yourself. So like, you know, if you're going to be nostalgic for 20 years ago, then 10 years ago, then 5 years ago, and he said you're going to get to a point where people are nostalgic for 30 seconds ago, and I think we've totally reached that.
Since we were talking about like the police state and future scenarios like 1984, I want to kind of get your comments on the whole like surveillance state. I know that's a major complaint we've had about it. Donald Trump is his support for surveillance.
Yeah, the NSA.
And I did read that comment. During the interview we did with Zoltan, we didn't really get a chance to get into it because it's pretty short. But I know Rabbit wrote on his blog post that his view was the opposite of his. He basically thinks that we should control immigration, but get rid of the surveillance state and have privacy online. Rabbit, you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting what Zoltan said. And that was only a 30-minute show, and so like, and it was kind of like, I didn't really want to challenge him on anything because I saw it more as like it was a venue for him to like get his his message out there and just kind of see what he's all about. But I think that it was interesting that he said that that he wanted like an open borders society but the people that come in that we would surveil them with like drones and like the whole shebang.
Yeah.
And I thought that was like I thought geez, instead of like all having all these drones following these people around and whatnot, like why don't we just like not bring them in? And especially I think that's just one of the big
It's like the George Bush neoconservative policy, like sailor calls invade the world, invite the world. George Bush continued to leave our borders open and let in like all these student visas from Saudi Arabia. Then he put in this massive surveillance state, and now all these people, like everything you do online is surveilled by the government. There's no privacy. So it's the worst of both worlds. Ideally, we should control our sovereignty and have basic privacy in our personal lives. I'm really appalled by the whole like surveillance state.
Yeah, I am too, and I found that to be like one of the great contradictions I see in transhumanism, because I consider myself to be kind of a transhumanist, but this notion that this movement that is really anti-religious, Zoltan's an atheist, and transhumanism always talks about how the problems organized religion has created and all this, and yet they're willing to import these millions of people from these radical religions or just from wherever. Like, these people aren't going to support transhumanism. They're not going to support an ideology that opposes organized religion, that wants people to live forever and like have sex with robots and all of this kind of stuff. Like, could you imagine you bring in these million people from Somalia, and then even though you may find some people of other races and whatnot, I would think at the very minimum you would want to have have it tightly controlled to people that are at least from a pro-science perspective, and not this group that would be, the goal of transhumanism is immortality, and you're going to bring in these groups that they have no interest in immortality. They think dying is like a natural part. It's glorified in a sense. Well, yeah, so there are, like I said, there are some, actually. Zoltan has written about some, black futurists and whatnot that he's friends with. But I think that even setting aside the racial component, you would think that, bringing in these people who never in a million years would vote for funding for sex robots and things like, people to marry machines, things like that. Like, these people from, Algeria are not going to be supporting that shit, you know, if you bring them in by the millions. Like, you know, transhumanism is going nowhere.
So, yeah, I wanted to chime in and give you guys my police state scenario, something that I could sort of see happening. And I'm basing this off the German model. So Hillary Clinton said that out of all the politicians in the world, she admired Angela Merkel the most. And what's happened in Germany is people who lived in fairly peaceful, homogeneous towns have seen the landscape severely change to the point where you walk out on the street and there are women in full-body niqabs everywhere, and the police siren is going off every 10 minutes, and the ambulance is always running down the street, and there are people screaming and crying, and it's this really strange sort of third-world situation developing in your own home. You're outside of your own home, things drastically change. And a lot of people in Germany, I mean, it's a very liberal country, you know, especially, well, basically because of the impact of World War II, they sort of crammed in the politics of guilt harder than anyone else. So for them to, you know, they don't want to feel upset about this happening, but it's such a drastic change of life that they sort of end up going crazy and really strongly reacting to it. And, you know, if some woman is a feminist and believes very strongly in, you know, sovereign, you know, powerful women, and she walks around and just sees women being, walks around her own hometown and sees women being abused by their husbands, being treated like cattle, if she sees this, she's going to really strongly react. And these people go on social media and say what's happening and try to warn their friends, and then the government is tied in with this, you know, corporate state emergence, and they just flag your comment and delete it. So people are in this nightmare terror state of having their world drastically altered, and they feel all this guilt, all this, the politics of guilt, they feel it very strongly, and they don't want to react against it. They're holding it in, and then when they try to react against it, the state shoots them down immediately. So that nightmare scenario,
what they use to sort of justify the whole surveillance state is both like the fear of terrorism, but also they use sort of the moralistic thing. And it's kind of like what Keith Preston said, every regime needs an ideology to justify its power.
Yeah, they need an ideological superstructure.
There's three things that they use to enforce internet government surveillance of the internet. There's terrorism, there is the whole underage sex scare, and then there's the whole sort of a hate speech stuff and racist stuff. It's basically those three factors.
I mean,
I was going to say there's also a newer one which you're starting to see, and that is the cop shootings. You know, they're starting to say that all these cops need to wear body cameras. Everything, absolutely everything, needs to be filmed. You know, to actually, you know. So we have this police state even going a layer deeper to monitor the police and all of these different groups. Also, you know, footage of, like, and it's used to justify that. So there's even like another layer of it emerging.
So the police state is policing itself. So you're saying?
Yeah. Well, you know, one thing Richard Spencer talked about this on his last podcast with Paul Kersey, where he talked about how, you know, that there really isn't this the state in the way that people used to think of it, because the cops are actually kind of finding themselves at odds with, you know, the cops are part of the state, but they're at odds with this government, you know, the government officials and the, you know, big business, you know, arm of the government that, you know, so it's like, even though the cops are part of the state, police forces are finding themselves, at odds with the state and actually being, you know, so they're part of it, but they're not part of it.
our next show, we're going to do on the topic of retrofuturism. Retrofuturism is how people view the past. I want to touch on kind of briefly about kind of the aesthetic visions of different things. So like capitalists have their aesthetic visions. There's traditionalists, even distributists have their aesthetic vision of small towns, villages. There's sort of the communist socialist aesthetic. I guess kind of like us as like radical centrists, do you think retrofuturism can be the aesthetic of our movement? And that's what our next show is going to be about.
Well, I feel like radical centrism doesn't, it can kind of have all of these ideas laid in within it. I think it's a mutable idea.
That's kind of what retrofuturism is. It is a mutable aesthetic for a mutable idea. You can have kind of like, there's like a steampunk, which is like Victorian.
Yeah.
There's a sort of mid-century.
You're looking to the past and the future.
The mid-century, like space age, and then there's the sort of 80s, like cyberpunk and like vaporwave aesthetic. There's all these different things. And I think that's like perfect aesthetic for radical centrism, because radical centrism is a movement about fusionism.
Yeah, I definitely get it. That's pretty cool.
So I'd like to thank Alex von Goldstein and Rabbit for being on. It's been a great show. And just to let you guys know, we're going to be doing our upcoming show on the topic of retro futurism. So check that out. But it's been a great show. Thanks, guys.